CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstud Show, the show where we talk about comics. Today it's just me. I got no co-hosts, but that's okay. I think I can rock it good. That was Sleater-Kinney off their last album, sadly. The Woods, the song Jumpers. Today I have a special guest. It is Megan Kelso. Megan has a selection of fine comics. Squirrel Mother, most recent one from Fantagraphics. Queen of the Black Black, which came out from High Water Books, which sadly doesn't exist anymore, but a good comic store will still have it in stock, as well as stuff in anthologies, Dirty Stories 3, Bogus Dead, and her own anthology she put out. Now, please don't kill me if I mispronounce this. Shrezda?
Scheherazade.
And you know what? I think I did that same as pronunciation before when I had Gabrielle Bell on. So thank you for joining us today, Megan.
Oh, thank you.
Now, you are a Pacific Northwesterner person, so it's nice to have not only part of the month of Women in Comics on, but someone that's kind of from the same general area, because it seems like most people I talk to are in New York. So.
Yeah, well, I actually just moved back from New York in November. I was living in New York for the last 6.5 years, but we just got back to Seattle in November.
A good time to escape the New York winters, I guess.
Yeah, but I don't know. It was a pretty horrible winter here on the West Coast.
Did it get really snowy down there? It got pretty bad a couple of times here.
It snowed more than usual, definitely.
I thought global warming took care of that.
Who knows what's going on?
So I guess a couple of different things to talk about. I guess we'll start out what got you into comics, because you kind of come from a different generation, I think, than a lot of the women I've had on comics recently, and kind of come in like in a between time when there wasn't a lot of, you know, influence from people like Mary Fleener and stuff like that, I guess. Mm-hmm. But coming in after that, so I'm curious, like, how you got into comics.
Well, I didn't really grow up reading comics. I mean, you know, I read newspaper strips and occasionally things like Archie, but I wasn't really aware of comics as a real art form until I was in college, and I had a boyfriend who was really, really into comics. And I had always loved to draw and write stories, and he just was convinced that I should be a cartoonist, and he was always trying to get me to read comics, and it kind of didn't appeal to me, the stuff he was showing me. It's just,
was it all
not
like
that interested.
Superhero stuff, or?
Well, kind of a combination. I remember him really talking up Daredevil when Dave Mazzucchelli was drawing it. He just thought that was some genius work and thought I would like it, and I just couldn't really get interested. But he showed me alternative stuff too. He tried to get me into Love and Rockets, and you know, it just didn't really do much for me. But finally he gave me a Julie Doucet comic book, and that really blew my mind. And that was the comic that made me think, maybe there's something to this. Maybe I should give this a try.
What do you think was the difference between that and the other ones? Just the honesty and kind of self and.
Well, I just love the way she drew.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, there's really, like, the way she draws, there wasn't any references to comic book style. I mean, even, you know, Love and Rockets, there's very much this, it's within a certain tradition of comic book style drawing, and Julie's wasn't at all. And, I mean, there are tons of cartoonists out there working who, you know, don't reference classic comic book style, but that was sort of the first cartoonist I saw. And it looked more like the kind of illustration that I had loved in children's books when I was growing up. And it just, the drawing really hit me on a gut level. I just loved it. Like, I wanted, you know, I wanted to live in that world that she drew. And I really think that was the thing that sucked me in and made me feel like, oh, I want to try that. That's neat.
Well, one thing I noticed kind of reading up on you is, really, comics became a passion for you. It's like, that's what you want to do.
It's true. It happened, you know, it happened pretty quickly. I read that Julie Doucet comic and thought, I need to try this. And I spent the last year that I was in college kind of trying to draw comics and trying to figure out how I would do it. And it just felt like I'd found a home. Because, like I said, I'd always liked to write stories and draw, and I felt like I was an artist, but I just hadn't quite found how to be an artist. And when I started doing comics, it felt totally right really quickly, and I kind of didn't ever look back.
Now, you went to school in Olympia, if I'm correct.
Yeah, I went to Evergreen.
And were you around a lot of the zine scene then, too?
Yeah, definitely, and that was definitely a big inspiration in terms of you know, throwing myself into this thing that I didn't have any experience or true knowledge of, because that was happening all around me. You know, it seemed like most of the bands that were forming, you know, were people who didn't know how to play their instruments, and that was okay. And, you know, people were self-publishing their zines and, you know, weren't looking for any sort of institutional approval for what they were doing. And so it was a really fertile environment for just trying a new thing and doing it yourself. So I definitely credit that whole scene in Olympia had a huge influence on me in terms of just being brave enough to just start this new thing.
A lot of, I guess the scene, there's a lot of really honest, empowering exposure is what,
yeah,
I can gather from my own knowledge.
Yeah, it was, you know, I hate to sound all sappy, but it was a really special time, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, I guess, the source of a lot of the, I don't know if the term is really great to use, but the Riot Girl movement. And,
well, it was. I mean, you know, it absolutely was.
Wasn't that where she first started publishing the zine?
Yeah.
When it was in Olympia?
Yeah.
So, I loved that music back in the day, so that's why I was happy to play the Sleater-Kinney. So, Girl
they
Here...
They kind of came after me. I think I'd graduated by the time they started their band, but they, I mean, we definitely came out of the same roots, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Now, Girl Hero, when did you start that after school?
Well, I actually started Girl Hero as a little mini comic / zine while I was still in college. I got an independent study contract to do it. And the first Girl Hero was 10 pages long. And then I graduated and moved to Seattle, where I'm from, and kind of tried to keep going with the comics. And then about a year later found out about this grant, the Zarek grant,
mm-hmm,
that you could get to self-publish your own comic. And I decided to apply for it, and I got a grant. And so that was the beginning of real Girl Hero, like the 24-page, you know, offset-printed comic version of Girl Hero.
The magazine size.
So that was
size.
Like in 93. I think the first issue came out in 93. Yeah. I graduated from college in 91, and the first Girl Hero came out in 93.
What did you take in college?
Well, I started out actually going to art school at the Art Institute of Chicago.
The prestigious.
But I only lasted one semester.
Oh.
Yeah, it was a big mistake. So then when I transferred to Evergreen, I kind of stayed away from art for a while, and I studied mostly history and political science and economics.
That's what I'm taking, without the economics part.
Yeah.
In college right now.
Well, I felt after the art school debacle, like, I really wanted to know some things.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel like I had anything to say in my work, and it felt like a stupid teenager, and I thought, I need to actually get educated. I need to learn some stuff. And I think that's why I started with history. I thought that would be a good place to start. But then the art sort of slowly sucked me back in. And by my senior year at Evergreen, I was doing photography and comics. And yeah.
I can definitely see how the history parts become an influence in some of your comics. Did it work in to the fair amount of, like, kind of structuring stories?
Well, the first Girl Hero stuff I did was absolutely just a reflection of all of the labor history and feminist studies that I was doing in college. It's kind of embarrassing because it's just so overt.
Rawr.
It's just like, this is what I learned in college, and I'm going to do a comic book about it. But I, over time, I feel like I've kind of found my voice, the history stuff, I think, is coming in a more natural way. It's something that's always been interesting to me. Even when I was in high school, history was always my favorite subject. And, the whole series I did about Alexander Hamilton,
that's,
I guess, is
that was right where I was
going to
lead into is...
Yeah.
Why Alexander Hamilton? It just seems he stuck with you.
Well, I remember him from my American studies in college, how I remember our professors talking about how he basically designed, you know, the financial system that we still have in this country today, more or less, which I thought was really interesting. And then a few years ago, sometime in the 90s, I watched this Rick Burns documentary about New York, the history of New York City, and Alexander Hamilton was a really big part of the early New York days. And I just sort of remembered how much I love that guy. And it just kind of grew from there. I don't know. When we first moved to New York, one of the first kind of touristy things I did was to go down to Trinity Church and look at his grave.
Wow.
Yeah, he's just my guy. I can't help it.
Well, it's kind of like a love letter to him.
It is. I totally have a huge old crush on Alexander Hamilton. I can't help.
But then you did a zombie comic about him.
Well, that was because I was sort of in the middle of my first flush of Alexander Hamilton when Jerome was soliciting stories for the zombie comic, and I just thought, wouldn't it be funny to, you know, sort of do a mashup of Alexander Hamilton and zombies? And it just kind of seemed, I felt like it wasn't too forced, so, you know, I just kind of went with it.
And I guess that's his actual grave site that you took a look at. That's
it is
in it.
Indeed.
I'm trying to remember the page number, but I just can't.
It's sort of a big marble pyramid sort of shape.
Kind of
grave.
Like an obelisk.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not huge, but it's bigger than pretty much any other grave in that cemetery. So it definitely stands out.
Now, when you started doing, I'm going to totally backtrack now back to the Girl Hero stuff. When you started doing that, big function of stuff and was the Artichoke Tales. It's kind of like you had two different parts to the Girl Hero. What did you have envisioned when you started doing these different types of stories?
Well, it's not exactly how you describe it. When I first started doing Girl Hero,
been a while since I read
them,
I'm sorry.
Ongoing story called Bottle Cap.
Oh, okay.
That I was like half the comic would always be an episode of Bottle Cap, and then the other half would be a couple short stories. And that's sort of what I was talking about when I was doing comics that were like all that I learned in Feminist Studies 101, I put into Bottle Cap. And I was really passionate about it at first, but it just kind of, by issue 3, I just knew that wasn't, you know, it was kind of the superhero adventure story. I just knew that wasn't the direction that my heart wanted to go in terms of comics. And I sort of started putting a lot more energy into the short stories, and Bottle Cap just felt like this millstone around my neck. But I felt like I had to finish it, and I did. But by issue 6, which was the last issue of Girl Hero, I mean, you can tell by reading it that my love of that story has completely died, and I'm just kind of cruise control until the end. But in the next to last issue of Girl Hero, I did a short story called Penny Royal Tea that took place in the Artichoke Tales world. That was my first encounter with the Artichoke people.
I'll be honest, it's probably been about 15 years since I read the
Girl
Hero
comics. I know, these comics were all a really long time ago. It's okay. Just setting the record straight. So doing that story made me realize that I really liked that little world that I'd made up, and I wanted to expand on it. And so that's when I quit Girl Hero. I knew that the next big project I wanted to do was either a collection of stories or a graphic novel in that world. And that's what Artichoke Tales is. And I started it in 1999, and I'm not done with it yet. I'm really close. I'm working on the last chapter right now, but it's just taken me a really long time because, you know, I'll get freelance jobs that actually pay money, and then I'll quit doing Artichoke Tales for a while, and then I'll go back to it, and there's just been a lot of interruptions along the way.
Do you have a set idea of what you're doing with it, or do you kind of change as you get distracted and come back to it?
Well, luckily, I had a pretty clear game plan from early on that it was going to be 6 chapters. It's this sort of intergenerational saga, and the structure of it is pretty tight. So it's actually been pretty easy to leave and then go back to, because I've always had kind of our overarching plan for it. But, I mean, I started it in 1999, so, of course, it's changed a lot over the years. And when I finish it, I am going to have to go back and tinker a little bit with the beginning, because some things don't match up anymore, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
But it's basically the same story that I originally planned, more or less.
It's pretty interesting, because you look at it just like, you know, just kind of glancing, it looks like, oh, look, cute little creatures, yada, yada. And then you read it, it's like a whole intricate political system with, like, inner strifes of cultural loss. And is that, like, something you're actively, we're trying to make it, like, this really easy to engage into but really complex world?
Well, I sort of glommed onto this idea pretty early on that, like, making kind of grim, complicated stories with really cute characters is, like, works really well. I mean, a lot of cartoonists employ that strategy, and it sucks me in every time. I mean, I always go for the comics about the cute. Like, I love Brian Ralph's comics so much.
Yeah.
His characters are really cute. And his comics, you know, get pretty serious and grim, but you sort of get tricked into reading it because it seems so adorable at the beginning.
Kind of innocent and playful.
What?
Kind of innocent and playful.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely consciously employed that strategy. But all along, I knew I wanted it to be sort of about Civil War. And when I started, I think I was thinking more American Civil War, but the funny thing is that there's been so much civil war around the world in the time that I've been working on that comic, you know, like in Bosnia and now in Africa, that, like, all of that has sort of filtered in terms of thinking about, you know, how civil war, you know, between a culture that was once very closely connected, how that all kind of plays out in terms of families and relationships and stuff, so that's all been kind of percolating in there.
It's like a dissolving of cultural mores.
Mm-hmm. And how do you, you know, when your friends then become your enemies, how you have to forget certain things or reject certain aspects of your culture because that's part of the enemy culture, that whole stuff. I mean, so much of that's going on in Africa right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I haven't even, with Artichoke Tales, I haven't even begun to really touch on that, but that's definitely been a big sort of real-world inspiration while I've been working on it.
Well, the stuff in Africa is just so dense, I guess,
yeah,
to really capture it.
Yeah. Well, I haven't even tried. I mean, really.
Yeah. I think it would be interesting to see some kind of, I don't know, embellishment of it or using it in the contextual stuff, because it is such an interesting thing and a lot of people really don't have any idea of what's happening there.
Yeah.
And it seems, looking through other stuff, is war is one of the things that kind of sticks out, or maybe it's just a couple of pieces where you have this definite viewpoint on what's happening. That's thinking of the one thing you did with Ron Rigi in The Squirrel Mother.
Mm-hmm.
What was it that the two of you had in mind?
Well, it was a sort of accidental collaboration because I broke my wrist the summer before I did that comic, and Ron was actually with me when I fell and broke my wrist. And although it had nothing to do with him, he always felt really responsible, like he's always apologizing. I know, and it had nothing to do with him.
He's such a nice guy.
He was absolutely not culpable, but he always sort of felt like he was. And so I had agreed to do this comic for Arthur Magazine. They solicited a bunch of comics about the war because it was right when the Iraq War had started. And I had this whole plan, I had this idea that I really liked, but when I just, like, I drew it, but I just couldn't ink it. My hand just hurt too much. And I kind of took advantage of the fact that Ron had felt bad about me breaking my wrist. And I said, Ron, will you do me this really big favor? And he agreed to do it. And I just loved how it came out. Like it's definitely Ron's line, but it's also my line. And
well, that's what I noticed. I didn't know it was you and Ron. I read it, and it looked like your work. I'm like, oh, it's got some Ron influence. And I'm like, oh, well, no wonder. At the end.
Yeah, it was really, I loved how it came out.
And it's probably one of the more straightforward stories he's done, too.
Yeah, well, since Bottle Cap, I haven't done a lot of what I think is overtly political stuff, but the time and the place, it felt like it called for it, you know, Arthur Magazine, newspaper strips, short, and that moment of just feeling so, like, we'd completely lost our minds. So,
it was something you felt passionate about.
I did, and I don't really feel like I have the knack really for overtly political cartooning, and I find it really difficult because it's sort of the opposite of how I like to work. I like to be ambiguous, and it's really hard to be ambiguous when you have a political point to make. But yeah, the timing was just right for that, and I'm glad I did it. I tried to do a fair amount of, protesting before that war began, and, obviously it came to nothing, mm-hmm. but I'm still glad I did it.
Well, does that carry over into the strip you did for the New York Times, Watergate Sue?
Mm-hmm.
Does that kind of carry over that same, because I'm just looking, like, making my own observations of, because you have a 2-year-old child now.
Yeah.
And the story is about, someone being pregnant, a woman being pregnant during the Watergate hearings. And is that your own, like, kind of observations in part during, well, you're pregnant and kind of observing what was happening with our own, or your own, not my own government, but your government, sorry.
I guess in a way, I actually had a plan to do a graphic novel about Watergate for a really long time. Like, I got the idea probably, like, right after I started Artichoke Tales, really. I thought, okay, when I finish Artichoke Tales, I'm going to do a graphic novel about Watergate. And I've had a notebook all this time, and whenever I get ideas, I jot things down. But this Artichoke Tales is taking for so long, I never dreamed that, I would still be working on it. But anyway, when I got this New York Times gig, I had very little time to ramp up and start that story. Like, I found out in the middle of December, and they wanted an idea by the middle of January.
And you started in April, right?
And then it started running in April. So I just didn't have time to start something completely from scratch. So I thought, Watergate, because I have all these notes. I did all this thinking. I'd already done a little bit of research. I was partway there. But I also knew, I had just had, let's see, Virginia was 8 months old, I guess, when I started that job, and I was still very much in baby world.
Mm-hmm.
I'd only just kind of gotten back to work on comics, and my whole life was kind of baby, baby, baby. So I knew that I had to incorporate that into the work because that was where I was at. That was where my passion was. And so, again, I kind of like doing that, taking sort of two really disparate subjects and figuring out how to make them work in a story. So pregnancy and Watergate, how's that going to work? But it is true that, not so much when I was pregnant, but like while being in New York and listening to like lots of congressional hearings about Iraq and all of that, it did make me think of those Watergate memories of my mother watching Watergate, and it did kind of, there was some resonance there for sure.
It seems like through it all, your work or a pejorative amount is family is an important theme. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm.
As far as like utilizing in your storytelling?
Yeah, I had to write a little description of Squirrel Mother for Fantagraphics. And I said that the book sort of seemed evenly divided between sort of small personal family stories and larger historical political stories. And my ideal is to try to do both in one story. And that's certainly what I was aiming for in Watergate Sioux. I'm not totally sure that was a success, but that's kind of my holy grail, is being able to do little and big all in one. And my favorite, you know, my favorite writers are the kinds of writers who can kind of do big and small all in one. Like, I think Ian McEwan's a really good example of that. And so that's sort of, you know, that's what I'm aiming for as the second half of my career or whatever, is to really try and get a handle on that.
Well, it's interesting because it's not a topic necessarily covered as much in the comics. Really, it is talking about family, but not in a way that's not talking about abuse. It's not talking about trauma, but just mm-hmm. more relationships.
Yeah. Well, I remember, I can't remember exactly which story I had this thought, but I remember thinking, what if you told a story about a family and, like, quote, bad things happen, but, you know, nothing truly tragic comes as a result of it?
Is it the one with the slideshow?
Maybe.
Because I found that really
interesting.
I feel
like I've been kind of, like, working that theme for a while now. But, like, I mean, I think a lot of people my age have this experience that you look back on your childhood and you think, my God, my parents neglected me. Because, like, by today's standards, parents in the 70s were really lax.
Yeah.
I mean, I know
that. Go out and play, kid. Just leave me alone for a while.
But we were left alone a lot and left to do, you know, just kind of go out in the neighborhood and come back at a certain time, and who cares what you do. And, you know, my parents drank a fair amount. I mean, they didn't, I don't think they were alcoholics. I know they weren't, but, you know, they partied, and we were there for that. And I just feel like I wanted to tell the story of that kind of upbringing because, I mean, certainly there's repercussions. Like, there's some memories of some hard times, but it all turned out okay. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I don't feel like my sister and I are damaged people because of what happened in our childhood. I mean, obviously we are who we are, but it all turned out kind of okay. And I guess that's sort of what a lot of my stories are, that story I tell over and over, that things that are kind of messed up can happen in families, but, you know, life goes on and people get over it. Well, and that's not to say that it's not totally legitimate to tell the really hard stories of abuse and everything, but that's not my story, I guess.
No. And I think that's important, though, is telling a story that's honest to you.
Mm-hmm.
And not, yeah. You know, some people may just go out and try and do the most graphic thing just to kind of impact, but, you know, I think that level of honesty in storytelling can read through.
Well, and I do get really tired of this sense that, like, a crime has to be committed, a murder has to happen in order for it to be an exciting story. You know, like, what is that? That is not most of our lives. No. You know, like, the drama of most of our lives is pretty prosaic. And I think that a good storyteller can still, you know, imbue a story with a lot of tension and interest, even if, you know, nothing objectively that dire happens.
One thing I'm wondering about, because this is my focus on talking to women in comics, is recognition International Women's Day, is you did the anthology I mentioned earlier, mispronounced. I'm a horrible person. Horrible person I am. In that anthology, in your introduction, you wrote about the challenges of putting together an anthology of female cartoonists, because in one part, putting together a great anthology of talented cartoonists, but it's, on the other part, it's like, look at me, I'm putting together an anthology of women.
Yeah.
Do you mind talking about that a bit, and just what you had in mind when you started working on the anthology?
Well, I think what got me going was that it was when I was living in New York, and I felt really surrounded by a group of what I thought were really talented young women cartoonists. And, well, like you said, when I got started, there were, you know, there were women cartoonists out there. It's not like I was any kind of pioneer, but it still felt kind of rare and kind of few and far between. And there I was in New York and just, you know, in Brooklyn, just like in my immediate surroundings, I knew five or six women who I thought were doing really interesting, amazing work, who had a lot of potential. And then I, you know, I would meet other women at various comic shows like SPX and Ape, and it just felt like there was this sort of critical mass forming who were mostly a little bit younger than me. And I just, you know, they have mostly all gone on to do really interesting work and have success. I mean, I don't think they needed Scheherazade for that. But at the time, you know, they were a little bit under the radar. They were mostly doing, like, mini comics and stuff. So I just really felt like it would be fun to do this book, and it would also be fun to see if I could sort of be an editor, because I've always really liked the role of editor, and there's kind of not a lot of that in comics, and it was sort of an experiment to see if I, you know, if I could help these cartoonists in any way by having sort of more of an editorial hand in their stories. And that was just a really interesting project because, you know, some of them I worked really closely with, and there was a lot of give and take, and others, you know, just like held me at a very great distance and made it very clear they had no interest. And so each relationship was a little bit different. But, I mean, when I invited them to be in it, I said, this is how I want to do it. So they knew that, on some level I was going to be sort of more involved than the typical anthology editor.
Well, it seems like there's more of a focus on quality than quantity.
What?
Seems one problem with anthologies is, you know, it's a mixed bag, but it sounds to me like you're more focused on the quality than the quantity.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, I was definitely, I was attempting to kind of work around some of the things that seem like pitfalls with anthologies. I mean, it's a sad story for me because it all kind of turned out badly with the publisher, and I actually disowned the book, and it's kind of a heartbreaking thing for me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But the part of it, like having the initial idea and working with those women and getting that group all in one place, like I feel really good about all of that, but the end product I feel really badly about because it was just printed so badly, and some of those women's stories, the art was just pretty much destroyed. And, you know, I was the editor. I have to take ultimate responsibility for that, and I feel like I kind of let a lot of them down. And, it was a difficult experience.
I feel so bad breaking it up now. Sorry.
That's okay.
Working with, here, I can try and change it a little. Working with some of the women, did it change your own cartooning?
Working with the women just who were in Scheherazade?
Yeah, I'd like doing the editing stuff just on your own cartooning, seeing how people do different things. Did that change anything for you?
Not like in a really conscious way.
Okay.
I mean, that's an interesting question, and I can't think of any like concrete example, but I do know that I learned a lot, and it was really fascinating to see how differently people worked and to feel like a part of that. Because one of the things that I asked people to do was they sent me kind of a short description, written description of what they were going to do. Then they sent me rough pencils, and then they did the final version. And it was, I mean, it really was a privilege to be able to see people's process. And I just felt like I learned a lot about kind of comics in general by doing that. And I actually, at the same time I was starting to write about comics more, I've written a few short pieces for the Comics Journal about comics, about different cartoonists, and that whole time doing Scheherazade and writing more about comics, definitely I felt like was a period of growth. And it was interesting because it wasn't necessarily about, you know, learning to draw better mm-hmm. or anything like that, but it was a way of thinking more carefully about how comics work and what makes them good and stuff. And so, yeah, I definitely learned a lot in that regard.
What kind of stuff did you write about Comics and Journal? Because I didn't know actually you wrote stuff for the journal.
Well, the first thing I did was there was a Women in Comics issue that Anne Elizabeth Moore edited, and she asked me to write something, and I wrote a profile of the cartoonist Jennifer Daydreamer. And then I wrote a little review of High Horse Comics.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with them?
I am.
Yeah.
Somewhat.
And actually that, it was all sort of tied together because High Horse was one of the things that kind of inspired me to do Scheherazade in a way. Because I just really loved that comic and like how sort of disparate they were, and yet it all kind of tied together. And then there was an issue of the Comics Journal that had a whole bunch of stuff about Fort Thunder, and I wrote a little profile of Leif Goldberg.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's it. I wish I could say I'd written more because I love writing about comics, but it's really hard. It's very time consuming, and you know, it's time that then I'm not doing my own comics. So,
mm-hmm.
But I always learn a lot, and I always sort of love comics even more after I've written about them.
Jennifer Dreamer was a big influence for you.
Yeah, she, you know, she's a contemporary of mine. We were in a little comics group, critique group together here in Seattle in the
okay.
early 90s, and I think Tom Hart introduced me to her, and she's a couple years older than me, but we're basically contemporaries. But I just felt like she had this kind of innate talent that I would never be able to approach, and I feel like I just stole from her. Right and left, like I just couldn't help myself because I just loved the way she drew, and I loved the sort of mysterious worlds that she created in her comics, and I just wanted my comics to be more like that. So yeah, she was a big influence on me.
What do you have any comments on the change and role of women in comics? I had Francoise Moulet, I got to make sure I pronounce it properly, on last week, and we're talking about when she was doing Raw, there wasn't necessarily that much engagement with women in comics, but, I mean, that's obviously blatantly changed now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have anything to say?
Well, I think it's a good time for women in comics for a lot of reasons, but I think one of them is that there's a whole, you know, there's a whole kind of, whoa, graphic novels, they can be literate,
mm-hmm.
kind of in the
they're not
pop
just for
culture
kids.
Right now. There's like this, whoa, graphic novels thing going on, and Persepolis has a lot to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I know this is a generalization, but I feel like the kind of comics that a lot of women do are not so influenced by superheroes, not so influenced by the kind of underground, iconoclastic, crumb type of thing. They tend to be more sort of bookish and literary, and that kind of seems to be the kind of comics that are getting attention these days. And a lot of men are doing comics like that as well, but I just feel like there's just a lot of strong women cartoonists doing work in that area of comics, and that's the area of comics that's being paid attention to right now. So the timing is just really kind of nice. And also, I think, you know, I mean, I've heard in studies that more women are buying books these days, more women are reading fiction these days than men. And so the audience is sort of changing as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think comics is still sort of standing on the fringes of the book world, but there's certainly, you know, a lot more inroads being made, and a lot of those inroads are being made by women, you know, like Alison Bechdel's book and Marjane Satrapi and all kinds of people whose names are escaping me right now. But in this world of like graphic novels that can like peacefully coexist with, you know, literary novels at the bookstore, those types of books, you know, a lot of women are doing that kind of work right now.
It's a good time to be into comics right now.
Yeah, it seems like it.
When you were involved with Highwater Books, did working with some of those guys influence your own?
Oh my God, yes. Yeah.
Like Brian.
Like Ron and Brian, especially Ron Rigi and Brian Ralph, like the way they drew and the kind of comics they were doing had a huge, huge influence on me.
Because I have one of the Artichoke Tales, one of the mini comic versions, and I've used to have the Girl Heroes. I don't know what happened to them. You lose things over the years. But I mean, it's a completely different feeling I get mm-hmm. from what I remember reading it and reading this. And it just seems like, I guess, kind of stepped up the game.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say enough about also Greg Cook, like the influence that all those guys had on me was just gigantic and inspiring. And I feel like I definitely went in a different direction as a result of being around those guys and reading their comics and talking to them about comics and sort of seeing what they were doing and being inspired by them, for sure. Yeah.
It's a whole different comics world after that.
Yeah, yeah. And it was, I mean, I'm sad that Highwater couldn't continue, but it was, you know, a life-changing experience to be, you know, to be involved with them.
That's from.
And I feel like, you know, on like a visual level, I don't feel like I've been that influenced by Jordan Crane, but Jordan and I have like, we've just talked about comics so much over the years, like just emails and phone conversations, and he's a real seeker in terms of like process and how you get your work done every day and writing and so Jordan, I mean, the art side, I don't think there's as much of a connection between me and Jordan, but definitely just thinking about comics and how to get your work done and all of that, he was a huge, I mean, he wasn't ever officially Highwater, but he really was
mm-hmm.
because that whole group, you know, they
well,
hung out.
I know him and Brian are very tight.
So yeah.
Well, it seems interesting because I had Ron on last year, and he talked about how it was just so neat that they just kind of pushed and just did whatever you could as far as just doing comics, just put something together, and there's a comic, and it's not going to be the same thing you've seen before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What kind of process do you do for working on your own comics as far as from thought to pen to paper?
Well, when I started out, I would practically write my comic out word for word because I was just so much more comfortable as a writer than a drawer. I would basically write a short story and then translate it into a comic, which, you know, is really not an ideal way to go about making comics. And over the years, as I've become more comfortable with the form and more comfortable as a drawer, it's, you know, it's become a little more balanced. And like when I did Watergate Sue, I was so pressed for time that I did my rough straight as comics. Like I really didn't write anything except just a couple notes of like, this is going to happen and this is going to happen. But I was composing them initially as comics. And I would say that is the first time that I ever did that. Like before the initial creative stuff was in written form. But I just didn't have time for that with Watergate, so I was sort of forced to become more of a true cartoonist. And it was great. I mean, that was one of the things about doing Watergate Sue that was the most valuable to me, is that the time crunch kind of forced me to work differently and learn how to work differently.
It seems with that one, it just flows so freely, but you still are able to, like, put in a lot into the story, too. So it seems like a successful amalgamation, or lack of amalgamation.
Yeah, maybe. I had this matrix to fit how I was going to fit everything in historically, and then all of the sort of family events and the pregnancy. Like, it had to be really tightly scheduled.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I only had 24 episodes, and I had to hit these highlights of Watergate, and I had to hit these highlights of the pregnancy. So I had this graph, basically.
What happened when and what's going to happen when.
Yeah, but I didn't go into detail. It was just very bare bones. And then when it came time to rough out the episode, that was when the sort of narrative details would come. And I have to say that, you know, I only worked that way sort of out of necessity, but it was kind of great, like, to have, like, this very rigid structure, but have that be very spare, and then wait until I was actually drawing the comic to put in all of the, you know, the true meat of the story.
One thing that's kind of neat about Watergate, Sue, is that you're kind of playing with, I guess, gender roles
mm-hmm.
in it, with the helpful tips.
Agnes Bluebird?
Yes. Is that something, like, important as far as, like, kind of showing that separation, you know, post-intro feminism, but still kind of, like, that part, I don't know, just kind of playing with what are the family dynamic roles?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, that was a huge aspect of the 70s was, I mean, we think of the 60s as being the big revolutionary generation, but really in terms of women and women going back to work and family life transforming, that was the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And the early 70s, in a way, in a lot of ways, like, just from sort of my own recollections and doing some research, had a lot in common with the 50s. I mean, there were certain aspects of American life that were pretty untouched by the 60s, but I would say there was pretty much no aspect of American life that was untouched by the 70s. And, I mean, I feel like Watergate Sue really would have been better off as a graphic novel. I mean, having to do it in 24 episodes, I had to cut a lot out. And one of the things that I wanted to do with Agnes Bluebird was to, you know, in her little household hints, comic strip sort of reflect that change from the sort of straight-up 50s housewife to kind of having to acknowledge that that's, you know, that's no longer where women were at. And she's trying to sort of run to catch up with, you know, where women are going. But
and that's
still,
she kind of knew that people weren't... It society's changed. She's like, but this is still a good idea. You
right.
can try this.
Yeah, yeah. But I, you know, there. The funny thing is that there's, I don't know if you're aware of this, not being a woman or a mom, but, like, there's this whole domestic revival going on right now. And it's, like, there's certain different levels to it. There is, of course, Mother Martha Stewart, but there's also, like, it's all punk rock to, like, stay home and bake and knit
yep.
now.
You like, give your baby, you know, socks with skull and crossbones on them. And
yeah, and there's just this whole, like, I feel like there's this generation of women who are a little younger than me because I kind of came to motherhood old, who are trained to sort of reinvent domesticity. But domesticity is sort of intractable. I mean, you still have to feed the kids and get the house, you know, sort of clean and do the dishes and do the laundry. I mean, that stuff remains, whether you have, like, a punk rock kid in a little, you know, Ramones shirt or not. And so that was also an element that was running around in my head while I was doing that comic, that, like, the kind of domestic goddess thing that, like, Martha Stewart and before her, there was, you know, Betty Crocker and this woman, Peg Bracken, who wrote this book, The I Hate to Cook Book, that my mom loved when I was little. You know, there's always been these sort of domestic goddesses to kind of talk to that current generation of women who are trying to get their kids raised and their house taken care of. And it's,
something
it changes with the times, but it never really goes away.
That's definitely something I saw, because I'm 30, so like I have a lot of friends that are having kids or had kids, and it's definitely like, you know, I see people who before they had kids were very much about, like, you know, the very independent spirit, and it's still independent spirit with the kid, but it's still like that different take on the family dynamic.
Yeah.
But there's still like that maintenance of, I guess, functional motherhood.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I'm at the end of my time slot. The next show is staring at me through the window. So thank you so much for joining us today, or joining me.
I had fun.
It was, like I said, I'm a big fan, and I look forward to the eventual release of Artichoke Tales.
Well, thanks, Robin.
But till then, we still have Squirrel Mother, and people can read the Watergate Sioux online for free.
Yeah.
So thank you very much, Megan.
Okay,
and I hope you have a swell day. Bye. That was Megan Kelso. You can get a Squirrel Mother pretty easily through Fantagraphics, and she's got a slew of other stuff out. Some comic stores still have Queen of Black Black. I think it still might be available through Bodega Books. That might be an option. I think they still have some Vermini comics. And like I said, online New York Times, if you just Google Watergate Sioux, you'll probably be able to find it, no problem. Up next week, it'll be a surprise. So thanks everyone for tuning in. Check out online for some more interviews. I know I haven't posted any this week, but I will post some more, as well as this one, inkstuds.com. Up next, we got Crimes and Treasons. Thanks, y'all. I saw the violet turn to night. I saw the water turn to ice. Snowflakes hover around me, the world aglow. I heard a distant songbird singing, a song the words I used to know. I felt my